Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dot Foil Computer Services, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm very happy now to welcome Linda Siegel. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is just about time for the legislative session. Linda Siegel has been joining us for years.
Gosh. Five or six years,
yes. Almost as long as I've been doing this program. She is a lobbyist representing many different social services and healthcare nonprofits and associations, a longtime follower of the New Mexico legislature and the vicissitudes thereof, which we talk about. The legislative session starts this year on Tuesday, January 19th, and goes for 30 days. This year, we're going to, instead of speaking for 5 minutes twice a week, we're going to do an end-of-week recap on, I think, just about every Friday. Meanwhile, today we're going to talk about this upcoming legislative session, a 30-day session.
Well, good morning, Mary Charlotte. Thank you for having me back again. I really enjoy doing these shows.
Excellent. Well, it's great to have you, and it's incredibly informative for the listeners. Now, during a 30-day session, which happens every other year, what happens in comparison to a 60-day session?
Well, this is the even year session where the topic is just supposed to be the budget. Every year, the legislature and the governor are responsible for developing a budget to run state government. However, since Richardson has been governor, we've had some very ambitious 30-day sessions, and of course this is his last 30-day, his last session period. So he's going to have a number of bills on his call. And that's where he says, okay, I'm going to do a bill on DWI, and I'm going to do this bill on domestic violence, I'm going to do this bill on ethics, whatever. He gets to set the agenda, and then theoretically legislators can't introduce any bill that he has not authorized unless they rule it germane through each of the chambers.
So even though there's not really supposed to be bills, we're going to see bills, and we will talk today about those bills.
Yes, we'll probably see. Already we now have a system of what's called pre-filing, where legislators, even before the session starts, they can, you know, introduce their bill through pre-filing, and it already has a number, it's already listed on the website, and we've got about 80 bills so far.
We will talk about some of those in a moment, but first, the most important thing, which is the budget. We have this year a very serious budget shortfall. Why is that?
Well, it's been happening for the last couple of years. Of course, the economy, the downturn in the economy has really hurt New Mexico. We were a little slower in feeling that total impact. But the state government has had to cut its budget from a high in the 2007-2008 fiscal year of $6.2 billion. We are now down to about $5.1 billion. And looking at an additional budget deficit for the next year, which would be beginning July 1, 2010, an additional $650 million that we're going to be short. That means we've got to address it in either tax increases, which many of us support, or in totally decimating the safety net of our state government.
The safety net such as it is.
The already holy state safety net, yes.
So when we look at filling a budget gap, what are they actually looking at cutting right now or increasing taxes in some areas to fill? What are the numbers?
Well, the way it works with New Mexico, we're one of only five states where we produce two budgets as we go into the legislative session, the legislative version of the budget and the governor's version of the budget. Both of those versions have cuts of about $450 million, and both of the budgets leave that other $200 million out there as possibly tax increases. And though the budgets are similar, when you have to kind of compare it on a department-by-department basis, where the health department might be cut by $20 million in the LFC budget. It might only be a 3% cut in the governor's budget. So each of them has their own version of how to do it. We have concerns about cuts in health care, concerns of cuts in child care services when we're trying to get people back in their jobs, domestic violence, developmental disabilities. There's been a lot in the news recently about that. So all of those health and social services are going to undergo cuts in both versions of the budget. We also have public education, which makes up 45% of the entire state budget. So 45% of that $5.1 billion goes to public education.
And that doesn't include universities and
colleges.
Right.
Then you add on universities and colleges, you've got up to 60% of the total budget of the state of New Mexico goes to education. Well, in reality, you cannot not cut those because they're such a huge piece of the budget. And there will be cuts to all of them. The governor's budget and the LFC's budget differ by about $40 million for the higher education budget.
Now, how do you figure out where the fat is or where a department, let's say, could really be tightened up and made to work in a more efficient manner without reducing services?
Well, with a billion-dollar cut, remember I said we went from $6.2 billion 2 years ago to $5.1 billion now? There's not any fat left in government.
Is that really true?
I really believe that because I talk to people in these departments and they don't, at this point, they don't even have enough people to get out the billings. We're starting to see this in our safety net, in the Children, Youth, and Families Department with social workers, and we're seeing it like in the public safety. They're not even doing a cadet training in the next fiscal year. Well, how are they going to add any more public safety officers if they're not doing a training? There is just not much fat left anymore. Education.
Okay.
You know, I represent the Santa Fe Public Schools. They have laid off every extra person they can, and the next cuts are going to have to be in the classroom, and that's what other school districts are saying. At the Santa Fe Community College, where we all have relationships, we have more students. We have a 21% increase in students, and yet we have less people doing the work, and people are getting tired.
Fewer teachers, fewer administrators.
Yeah, there's just not that much to cut anymore.
Okay, so we got a problem.
Yes.
Okay, so what are the different ways that the various groups who are weighing in on the subject are looking to solve this big, fatless, fat-free budget problem?
Yes. Well, one of the things that many of us have been talking about and legislators have been talking about are ways that we could, yes, there's going to have to be some cuts, but we can't just cut government anymore. We've got to look at some revenue enhancements, and revenue enhancements are taxes. And there are some obvious taxes that we could do. In 2003, we essentially flattened out our progressive income tax to a point that our top rate is now around 4.9%. One of the proposals on the table is to look at a surcharge on people who make over $150,000, maybe paying a couple more percentage points in income tax. Maybe that's something that we would sunset after a few years, or if we reach a certain income level of the state revenues, take that back down. But that's a popular one.
Do we have any Wall Street bonus earners?
Well, we do have this interesting phenomena where the large corporations in New Mexico, Walmart, Target, Albertsons, Home Depot, if you're not a New Mexico corporation, you do not pay corporate income tax. on the money you make in New Mexico.
Legislators, come on.
And Senator Peter Wirth from right here in Santa Fe has been introducing that bill for the last 4 or 5 years, even when he was in the House of Representatives. Of course, he's now in the Senate, to require that a big corporation that's not incorporated in New Mexico pay the same tax that our New Mexico corporations pay.
That's crazy.
Yes, it is. It's totally crazy that...
Has that bill not passed? It doesn't make any sense.
How about corporate lobbyists?
But, I mean, what argument do they have?
Oh, that it will impact those businesses and they'll lay off people. I mean, they can't say they're going to move out of the state. Walmart's not leaving New Mexico.
Right, right.
And Home Depot's not leaving New Mexico. But remember, truth, justice, and the facts don't always operate in any legislative body because there's a lot of politics involved.
As we know.
Other taxes that are what many of us think are kind of no-brainers, like additional cigarette taxes, alcohol taxes.
And it'd be interesting if those taxes were funneled directly to health care.
Yes, yes, because we already know that we spend millions, it's about $186 million a year in tobacco-related illness in our Medicaid plan, and we're not taking in $186 million of taxes. We could put a dollar a pack, which would raise about $30 million. Other tax increases are certain taxes on coal, on other consuming energy kinds of things.
So fossil fuel polluting
right.
energy types.
Yes,
of
yes. Increase the excise tax on vehicles. We actually have a very low vehicle tax of just 3%, which is lower than our gross receipts tax.
3% of the value of your car?
Of what you pay, yes, yes.
Here in New Mexico, that might even the value of my car. Anyway.
Well, new cars, you know, would maybe generate some more money.
Right.
Decoupling our federal income taxes from our state taxes, that could raise about $16 million. Reducing the capital gains. We passed a bill also, I think, in 2003 that reduced the capital gains to 50% and rolling that back to only 25%. There's been a lot of talk of eliminating...
Wait, say that again.
Okay, so...
Capital gains tax used to be 50%.
It used to be, like, much higher than that, and we reduced it down to 50%. And if we reduce it even... Or maybe it's the other way around, 25, 50%. Anyway, changing the capital gains tax so people pay more on their capital gains.
And the argument for that is that capital gains is money that is above and beyond whatever income you're earning. You didn't earn it yourself. You might as well pay taxes on it.
Right.
And
right.
If you reduce the capital gains tax in trickle-down economic theory, which has proven to be completely non-existent in any kind of reality that we live in, the money doesn't go back into the economy.
Right, right. New jobs are not being created by that money.
By the reduction. Okay.
Right. The one that's been talked about a lot, which many of us oppose, is repealing the removal of the gross receipts tax on food. But what may come out of this session is a gross receipts tax on junk food, whatever that is, soft drinks and junk food. So we would still take it off of your meat and potatoes and vegetables, but we would put that tax back on potato chips and soda and candy bars or whatever. And that could actually raise millions.
You could go to the Centers for Disease Control website and see which foods are the worst for you. Or to Michael Pollan's website.
Right.
And just tax those.
Just tax those. Yep. The other popular one is putting a small increase on all the existing gross receipts tax we have, like a 0.25% tax increase or all the way up to a 1% tax increase. You know, right now, gross receipts taxes are 5% for the state, and then cities and counties add on. And I think in Santa Fe, we're up in the city to around 8%.
8 point something.
Yeah, so putting another 0.25 or even more could generate, like, hundreds of millions of dollars.
Now, that people who oppose that are opposed to it because it's a flat tax. So if you're making $9 an hour or you're making $800 an hour, taxes
you pay the same. Yeah, it's a regressive tax when you increase gross receipts that everybody pays, whereas increasing income tax is a progressive tax. And that's why many of us would like to see the some of the tax cuts from 2003 to personal income reversed or some kind of surcharge there. But now, we're going to see all kinds of bills introduced.
If all these tax cuts of the past had never been made in the first place, would we be in the trouble that we're in?
We wouldn't be as bad off. Now, obviously, the fact that the economy's downturn has hit New Mexico, that's dramatically decreased our revenue in the area of gross receipts, in the area of oil and gas. I mean, because the price of a barrel of oil has gone down, and natural gas, which we produce a lot of, natural gas is down to $4 or whatever their measurement is. And at one point, it was down to $2-something, where it had been at a high of $6 to $8. So those declines have really impacted the revenue. But
they haven't lowered our heating bills.
Oh, absolutely not. So we have a structural, what we call a structural deficit in our budget of somewhere around $600 million because of those tax decreases, and then we went up with our expenses, and the taxes are now down.
We're talking to Linda Siegel. It's the legislative preview. The legislative session starts on Tuesday, the 19th of January, and runs for 30 days until the 17th of February. So given all of these potential tax increases that you just mentioned, I mean, do you have the math there? If every single one of them were implemented, do you have an estimate of whether we'd still have a deficit, how much of a deficit we would still have?
Well, if we could, you know, we could implement enough tax increases to eliminate the entire $650 million deficit, but we're not going to do that,
right,
especially in an election year. So the legislature, through the Legislative Finance Committee, the governor, through the Department of Finance, has said they've got $200 million on the table for tax increases. Many of us would like to see that go up to $300 million. So we're doing about half in cuts and half in tax increases that are really targeted tax increases.
Now, those tax cuts, since there's no fat, once again, let's go to the methods that people have for trimming budgets. Where is it going to come from? Are there any departments that are considered less important than others?
Well, we're not seeing proposals to eliminate any departments, but we're seeing deep cuts to departments where staffing, vacancies, every department has a freeze on non-essential employees. So they're not hiring people, and they're saving a lot of money by not having all those salaries to pay, but it also impacts the services. And contracts, this is one of the most important parts, particularly in the delivery of health and social services. Cutting the contracts for the people out there in the communities doing the work. Health clinic contracts, domestic violence center contracts, child care contracts, developmentally disabled contracts, cutting the reimbursement rates in Medicaid to nursing homes and health care providers and hospitals. These are jobs. Not only are these critical services in our safety net to take care of people, these are also, when you cut a contract, there's going to be layoffs. So these kinds of cuts to state government mean that more and more people are going to be on unemployment. We're already running out of our unemployment funds.
And they're going to be using the very same safety net
that we don't have.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. We know that domestic violence incidents are up. We have already had to cut child care down to 100% of poverty when it was at 200% of poverty.
So 100% of poverty means the poverty line income.
Yes.
And the poverty line income is?
Oh, it's like $14,000 for a family of 3, I think. It's not livable.
No.
It's not a livable amount. And a lot of the people on child care services at 200% of poverty were the working poor, people who have the minimum wage jobs but can't afford $300 or $400 a month for child care.
Right.
Now, they don't have child care now.
Right.
And we've just seen about the developmentally disabled. That means that the services that those people are receiving will be less, fewer services. Medicaid, you have hospitals that say, we're already doing, in the state, all the hospitals are already doing almost $400 million of uncompensated care. Nobody pays them for that. When you reduce the Medicaid rate to them, that just means more uncompensated care. And that means, again, jobs.
We're talking to Linda Siegel. Hey, I have an idea. Why don't you require all these big box stores to either pay corporate taxes or provide full child care to their employees?
That's a good idea.
You heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen.
Don't think that'll happen, but...
Well, I mean...
How about full health care benefits?
Full health care benefits, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Some do. Many don't.
Right. So, again, we know the dire consequences of making cuts. How do legislators go about making the choices of what to cut? I mean, obviously, education has been considered sacred in the sense that they don't want to cut education budgets at all, or if so, very little. Is that still true?
Well, it's going to be hard for it to be true. Because, as we talked about earlier, public education is 45% of the entire budget. The cut in the special session to public education was around 2%, which was less than all the other departments got cut. But we'll just have to see how much we can hold education harmless. But being such a huge part of the budget, I can't see that that's going to happen unless we can raise more revenue. And many groups are supporting that increase in revenue. What I think is important for the public to tell their legislators, if they agree with this, is that it's okay for you to raise taxes. We support you raising these taxes because we believe that education is important. We believe that the safety net is important. We believe health care is important, and you can't just cut. You also need to raise revenue. But tell your legislator that's okay. We want you to do that.
Hey, how about this? Legalize marijuana and then tax the heck out of it. You'd solve your budget problems in 6 months.
Yeah, and maybe not so many people would be in jail.
We're talking to Linda Siegel. Okay, so let's talk about the composition of the legislature. We have the House and the Senate. Democrats, Republicans, how is it balanced?
Well, there are 70 House members, and 45 of them are Democrats and 25 are Republicans. So there's a large majority in the House of Representatives that are Democrats. In the Senate, it's 25-17, 17 Republicans. And the majority is smaller there. In the Senate, we seem to have a lot more conservative Democrats. And in fact, it's the conservative coalition that actually runs the Senate, because the Senate leader, President Pro Tem Jennings, was elected with, I think, 9 Democrat votes and all 17 Republican votes. So there's a more conservative bend in the Senate.
And so what does that mean for various kinds of legislation getting passed and not? We've had a number of times the folks from Conservation Voters New Mexico on and really giving a scorecard on how people are voting for or against conservation issues. Do we have Democrats voting, for example, against conservation bills, conservation issues?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. The more conservative Southern or Eastern Democrats tend to not vote for environmental type bills, some of them.
And you never have Republicans voting for them?
Not in my memory.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
And in terms of this, how should we say it delicately, question of where is money being used to push votes around? I mean, certainly in Washington, we have just witnessed a lengthy health care debate with untold millions of dollars being successfully used to change the bills, the health care reform bills, in favor of the insurance companies as much as it's been possible for them to do so. How do things like that look in New Mexico?
Well, there's always the appearance that campaign contributions indicate support for certain pieces of legislation. I think one of the ways that that could be solved is with a bill that's actually going to be introduced in this session, and that is preventing corporations and lobbyists from making campaign contributions to candidates. And that's certainly what we need on the federal level, because we don't have health insurance reform for one reason: the big pharmaceutical lobby, then the big health insurance lobby.
So if you had a system in which all the lobbying in the world were allowed, but no favors or campaign contributions were allowed, then it would basically equalize the playing field. So people lobbying for domestic violence protection, people lobbying for cigarette industry protection would be...
the same?
Would be more or less the same.
Well, I think if you took money out of it, then the appearance of impropriety is gone. And that's why public financing of campaigns is an attractive alternative to...
the appearance of impropriety.
Well, you know, I can't really say that if I give somebody $1,000, that's for a vote on a bill. And no legislator would ever do that either. But
they wouldn't say that, but I mean, it would be something that, heck, you or I could do in our spare time, is look at the publicly available information of who is contributing money to which legislator, and then look at how they vote on that industry's issues. Does it line up?
And people could say, well, that's because that person already believed that way, and that group was just supporting him for money. But we have to get money out of politics. There's no question about it. If we're going to really have a level playing field so that the children can have the same representation as the large international, no longer even American, corporations.
Right, exactly. We're talking to Linda Siegel, who, just for full disclosure, which we said at the beginning, you do represent in your lobbying efforts with little or no money, but you represent children, healthcare, teachers, and so on.
Right.
How's that going for you?
Well, I really enjoy it, and I can make a decent living because I have a lot of clients.
So in this legislative session, which is 30 days, in which supposedly there are no bills, there are going to be some bills. Let's talk about them.
Well, here it is with pre-filing, which we talked about. This is a new thing that they've been doing for the last couple of years, where bills can be introduced before the session even starts and get assigned a bill number. And already we've got about 80 bills, memorials, constitutional amendments, which have been introduced. And we know that the governor is putting on his call several DWI bills, bills that would look at increasing penalties. We have 4 domestic violence bills like one that would say if you have a domestic violence offense, you can't really become a police officer, creating a
domestic... That's logical.
Yeah. Some tweaking of language, redefining household member. There will be a number of ethics bills also. The governor has put like 4 or 5 of those on the call. And the one I just talked about, where lobbyists and corporations can't contribute to campaigns, that's one. Creating an ethics commission, which has been introduced several times in the last few years, that's another one. Preventing contractors, if you get a contract with the state of New Mexico, that you can't make contributions or that they have to be clearly revealed. And those ethics bills are going to have a hard time, as they always have.
It seems like legislators, I mean, wouldn't you be embarrassed to vote against an ethics bill? if you considered yourself and wanted to represent yourself as an ethical legislator?
Well, there are lots of procedural things that can happen to keep bills from even being heard. So sometimes they languish in committees for a while and nobody gets an opportunity to vote on them. And sometimes, you know, there's lots of disagreement. Or a bill could pass one chamber and it gets to the next chamber and it doesn't pass. So there are other ways than just publicly voting that can keep bills from passing.
Now, another bill which you and I have talked about session after session after session is domestic partnership.
Right. The governor has put that on the call this year. It didn't pass in the last legislative session, but a strategy that we often use on all kinds of controversial bills is that you just introduce them year after year, and pretty soon you wear people down, and you also build support so that they pass. So domestic partnership will be on the call, and we'll see what happens with it.
And so that would allow same-sex and opposite-sex and whatever-sex couples to basically have the rights and responsibilities which are the equivalent of marriage.
The similar responsibilities and benefits of marriage. Because
almost, but not quite.
Almost, but not quite. Of course, because we have a federal law against marriage, you can't get those 1,006 federal benefits by marrying because...
A federal law against same-sex marriage?
Yes, yeah. There's a federal law. So even if there were marriage in New Mexico, it wouldn't be the same. And clearly domestic partnership is less. We can't address things like income tax because that would be way too confusing to try to do that, a similar situation with marriage. So there are some things that just can't be written into a domestic partner bill, but it is an important step for protecting gay and lesbian families and providing hospital visitation and inheritance rights and all kinds of things that you take for granted when you can get married.
And the things that constitute family and civil life.
Right. Another really important, quite topical bill or series of bills that are going to be introduced address this tax lightening issue, where in 2003 or maybe even earlier a bill was passed that said you can only increase property tax by 3% a year unless the house changes ownership, and then you can have huge tax hits to the new owners. And there have been two lawsuits in Bernalillo County where the district court judge has ruled that huge increase just because a new person owns it is not constitutional. So the governor's got a couple bills and a couple of legislators have bills that would try to fix that and put back in place for everybody that 3%, you can't go more than 3% a year, or attach it to the property rather than attaching it to ownership. So that's a hot one that we need to address. And it's hot because if we roll back to 2003 or later even levels, it could really impact the revenues of cities and counties.
In other words, they'd go down.
Yes, the revenues could decline because of all these steep tax increases.
It's an interesting question because I guess the logic behind it is if you, for example, are a family that has lived on a property since 1837 and you don't have very high income, then it's not fair. And there are certainly plenty of people who, if their property taxes were raised in accordance with the property value, mm-hmm. wouldn't be able to keep the houses
right.
that they've lived in forever.
Right.
And then when somebody finally buys it for $500,000, presumably if they can afford $500,000 price tag, they can afford the new property tax.
Right. Although, is that fair? I mean, that was the whole reason for passing that law to begin with, so people who are cash poor wouldn't end up with huge property tax increases. But is it fair to then say to the new owner, okay, now you have to make up for all these 10 years when we couldn't increase property taxes, and it's going to be a 30% increase.
Yeah, and that's actually a philosophical and
right.
fairness question that has multiple sides.
Right, right. So they're looking for a solution with it. We'll see if they get it.
And we'll get updates on all of
yes,
this stuff.
Yes, absolutely.
Let's talk about, as we do every year, some terminology. So when people are listening to the legislative update, that you and I do, and we'll be doing it on Fridays this year, or when they hear or read the paper or hear other things like that, they'll know what the heck is going on.
Right, or even hear the KSFR reports every day.
Exactly, which the news department does a wonderful job on.
Yes.
Okay, to drop a bill, that means to introduce a bill.
To introduce a bill, and then it gets assigned a number, a House number or a Senate number.
And by the way, and I've said this before, the New Mexico website, legislative website, is fantastic.
It is. You can look up bills. You can look up committee hearings. You can see who your legislator is and where they live and how you can contact them. It is great.
You can read the entire bill and that funny
yes.
text that it's written in and all of that.
Right.
Which is very important to do. And you can also find out how to contact your legislator, which, ladies and gentlemen, is also a very important thing to do. If you care about how your state is governed.
Right.
Okay, so committees. Let's talk about committees. That's a bill is introduced or dropped. What happens then?
Then it gets assigned two or three committees that it has to be heard in. And usually they're supposed to be committees based on the topic. So if it's like a health bill, that bill is going to go to the health committee in the House. And then it'll probably go to, if it has any money attached to it, it'll go to the House Appropriations Committee. And those committees then have to have a hearing on the bill where people come in, the experts and the legislator, and they provide testimony. Then people in the audience can stand up and support the bill, or they can stand up and oppose the bill. Then the committee asks questions of the sponsor, and then they vote.
Now, are all committee hearings public?
Yes, yes. Most committee hearings are public, and so people can come and testify.
And do people tend to exercise their civic right to do so?
A lot of people come, and we have a great new addition this year. We have a parking garage. That used to be one of the big impediments to people coming. They'd drive from wherever and have to drive around for 30 minutes looking for a parking place. And
that is so true.
Now there is a parking garage right across from the Don Gaspar side of the Capitol.
Excellent.
Yes.
So, okay, so then a bill passes out of Committee A, and then it passes out of Committee B, and maybe Committee C if there is one, and then it's ready to go to the floor.
Right. And every time it passes out of a committee, it has to be reported out on the floor as having passed that committee, and then it goes on to the next committee, whatever that is. And once it's done all the committees, it gets on the calendar of the chamber, and then the whole 70 or 42 members votes on that bill. And then it goes over to the next chamber where the whole process goes on again, going through two or three committees.
So it's not that easy to get a bill passed. It has a lot of hurdles to go through.
It does, and it takes a lot of time. It can be days in between one committee hearing and the next committee hearing. That's why in a 30-day session doing substantive bills, it can be pretty tricky, although there's not as many, obviously.
Now, at what stage do these congressional bodies actually debate the issues?
Well, every committee, remember this is the New Mexico legislature, every committee will debate it, ask questions, and then vote on it. Then when it goes to the floor of the House or the Senate, they will do the same thing. The only difference is when it goes to a chamber for the whole vote, to the House or to the Senate, you don't have any expert witnesses. It's just the legislators debating the efficacy of the bill.
So the expert witnesses would appear during the committees.
Right. And then sometimes expert witnesses will sit on the floor next to the legislator and help them answer questions. But the experts can never talk in the chamber. The legislator has to ask the expert a question. The expert whispers the answer to the legislator, and then the legislator will say it if the legislator doesn't know the answer. In some technical bills, there's no way legislators can know.
Right. Now, what does it mean to table a bill?
Tabling a bill most often occurs in committees, and tabling is a technique used particularly for controversial bills that you don't really want them reported out of the committee as a do not pass. So that bill just kind of disappears. There's a motion to table. If enough people vote for it, a majority vote for it, that bill is either temporarily or permanently tabled, and that's the end of it.
So when something is tabled, it's gone.
It's dead.
It's in the vortex.
And you really can't tell on the legislative website what happened to it because it just appears to be sitting in that committee.
Right. Now, another term is something which we don't have a whole lot of this session is pork.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have pork?
Well, we have a little bit of pork this time. We're gone are the days, like in 2007, when we had almost $1 billion in pork.
And what is pork?
Pork is, that's the pejorative name that we use for something that is very important in New Mexico. And that is the money that each legislator gets and the governor gets to build the infrastructure of New Mexico. We use it to build schools. We use it to build colleges and universities, community centers, libraries, water wells, wastewater systems, roads. I mean, it is our infrastructure money, and it's very important. And we don't have much this time. There are three kinds of capital outlay or pork. There's severance tax bonds, general obligation bonds, and then general fund money that we've used for capital outlay. And we have this session about $50 million in severance tax bonds, and then another $170 million for general obligation bonds. And those general obligation bonds have to go on the ballot in November. So if the public is still feeling a little shaky about money, it's possible that those bonds won't even pass, even though the legislature has approved them. Now, the other thing about the capital outlay is we have about $2 billion of unspent capital outlay, and I think people have been hearing about using some of that money to fill the reserves and keep state government running, although you don't want to use very much of it for recurring revenue because it's a one-time only shot.
Right, right, right. We're talking to Linda Siegel with the Legislative Preview, legislative session starting on Tuesday of next week. Governor Richardson, as you said, it's his last legislative session, and he is going to go on to we don't know yet what after his term as governor is over. What are his priorities this session?
I think his priorities, he's really been a leader in DWI. He's got some DWI bills that he wants to still see passed. He's been a good leader in domestic violence. He's supported ethics bills. I know he wants to see those passed because some of the things that have happened have tainted his reputation, and he'd like to be on record as supporting and getting these ethics bills through. I think that he also wants to try and address in a good way, a positive way, the financial crisis, because he was fortunate to be a governor in a time when we were riding high and had lots of cash, and we expanded state government, and we needed a lot of those services. We needed to start paying our teachers livable salaries. And some would question that we even do now with a $30,000 minimum. But teachers in the Santa Fe public schools before 2003 might start at $23,000. Well, that's almost unconscionable. So he did some very positive things with the legislature in increasing the education expenditures. And now we're going, oh, my God, what are we going to do? Because we don't have enough money. So I think he really wants to try and address the best that both the legislature and the governor can on how we can keep government going and keep education going.
A few more terms. One of them is memorial.
It is
not a cemetery-related thing.
Well, there's three types of legislation, basically. Bills, which can be about money or about substance. Constitutional amendments or joint resolutions, which have to pass the legislature and go on the ballot in the next general election for the public to approve. And then we have memorials. And memorials don't really have the force of law. We often use them to study things. Like one of my clients, the Cancer Alliance, is doing a memorial this session to look at how we can get more cancer clinical trials out in the rural areas. How can we afford to do that? So we would do a little study and then report back to the legislature. So memorials have to pass one or the other chamber, or sometimes both chambers if it's a joint memorial, but they're really mostly about studying things.
Another term you just used was joint resolution. What does that mean?
Right. That's that joint resolution constitutional amendment.
They're the same thing?
Yeah. You have some kind of issue where we need to amend the Constitution, and it has to pass both the House and the Senate, does not get signed by the governor, but then goes on the ballot in the next general election. An example of a constitutional amendment joint resolution that's already been introduced this session is one by Senator Bill Scherer from Farmington to define marriage as between one man and one woman, to amend our Constitution to clarify that.
Right, right. Now, if they went ahead and defined that, but the domestic partnership law passed...
Well, they really don't have anything to do with each other.
Very interesting. Caucus.
Caucus. That's where all the people of one party in one chamber get together and talk about their strategy and what they're going to do. So you're going to have a House Democratic caucus and a Senate Republican caucus. And there, during the special session, most of that session was taken up. Hours and hours of the caucuses, or caucuses, I don't know, meeting and talking and trying to strategize about what they were going to do in the special session about the budget.
Linda Siegel, before we go, what are the various ways in which citizens can get involved in the legislative process, and how effective are citizens in the legislative process?
I think this legislative session, that the legislators really want to hear from their constituents about taxes, about tax increases, about do we support keeping the safety nets of our government in place. And the ways to do that, you can, if you don't know who your legislator is, your House member or your Senate member, you can go on that legislative website, Google New Mexico Legislature, and it'll come up, and you can go into that website and you can find out who your legislator is. You can call them on the telephone. You can send them an email. You can write them a letter. You can find out when a hearing is that's on a bill that you really care about and come up to the session and testify at that hearing. You just walk into the hearing. You watch them put the bill on, and then they'll ask, the chair of the committee will say, who wants to talk? Who wants to support or oppose this bill? And people can talk.
Right. And for those, for example, who've been laid off from their jobs or who are looking for work and who really care about how their lives are going to go forward, and you have a little extra time on your hands, it's a great time to use that time to go to the legislature.
Hang out at the legislature. You will learn a lot. You will see a lot. These are just people. They're just like us. And they like to hear from their constituents.
Linda Siegel is our legislative correspondent, and she'll be with us here just about every Friday until the end of the legislative session. Once again, the session starts on Tuesday, January 19th, goes for 30 days. Linda, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. I'm Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. We're podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features a Something for Everyone show. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow with Robert Knott. Ciao.